Good evening. My name is Marcus Brooks, and I serve as the Chief Impact Officer here at the Foundation for a Healthy St. Petersburg. As we gather here tonight in the Center for Health Equity, it's important that we take a moment to thoughtfully and intentionally acknowledge our collective past as we show up fully in the present and prepare for the future that we are working to create together. This building, a once segregated grocery store, now stands as a place for shared learning, connection, and action toward a community where everyone can lead healthy lives. In this moment, we acknowledge that we share space of the ancestral lands of the Tocobaga, Miccosukee, and Seminole tribes. These communities cared for and sustained this land long before it was called St. Petersburg and continue to do so today. We honor their enduring presence, their resilience, their ongoing contributions to this region. We recognize that the inequities we work to address each day, those tied to health, opportunity, and justice, are rooted in history of policies, practices, and displacement that continue to shape our shared story. This acknowledgement is not symbolic, and I want to reiterate that. This is not about symbolism. It's an invitation for each of us in this room, each of us that may be watching this afterwards, to show up with awareness, humility, and accountability as we move forward. I now have the pleasure to bring to the stage Conan Gallaty with the Tampa Bay Times, who specifically told me that I didn't have to say his title because he's probably one of the most humble people ever. You kind of run the Tampa Bay Times, but whatever. And so in that vein, ladies and gentlemen, Conan Gallaty. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marcus. It's true. I am amazing at being humble. I am Conan Gallaty, the CEO of the Tampa Bay Times. And let me just say how wonderful it is to see all these smiling faces in the audience, that you were willing to join us tonight for what I think is going to be a very welcome conversation for me and hopefully for all of you as well. This is a trying time in our society, no doubt. And we're here to talk tonight about one of the most important human capacities, that of empathy. In a time of great isolation, a lot of digital noise that drowns out human connection, there's probably no better time for us to remember what we're capable of and the empathy that can bring us back together. Now, I'm going to assume that all of you are here because you'd like to bring more empathy into your lives. But making assumptions about a big group of people you've never met is one of the problems. So let's do a very unscientific poll here. How many of you feel like our society has become more resistant to people that they don't understand or don't look and think like them? Show of hands. Okay. How many of you have had to distance yourself from somebody who has gone off the deep end? Okay. How many of you brought somebody with you that's sitting right next to you that went off the deep end? You brought them here. Don't look at them. Don't look at them. Any of our panelists? Okay. How many of you want to find a way to connect to people, to a bigger community, people that don't think like you, and try to reach out and understand where they come from? You're in the right place, right? The show of hands, you can feel the energy in this room, right? We are, I want to say collectively, this is a moment of resistance, of us saying we want to get some of our society back, some of our normalcy back, and it starts here. It starts with this conversation. The reality, unfortunately, is that there are some very sobering facts about what's happened in American society today. 2/3 of all U.S. adults say they don't belong to any meaningful organization, no group, no formal society that they feel provides meaning in their lives. Since the pandemic 5 years ago, the number of people who say they don't have a best friend that they can talk to and share their feelings and their emotions with has grown 4 times. And one out of every two adults, half of all American adults, say they've had to distance themselves from a family member because of political or ideological reasons. This is a very troubling thing, and it creates a very sad society And to quote the great author and columnist, New York Times columnist David Brooks, a sad society eventually becomes a mean society. Tonight is part of the Tampa Bay Times Spotlight Series, a series that we began 2 years ago to raise the level of debate on the most challenging topics and the biggest opportunities that face our community and our region. We have covered a wide variety of subjects, everything from affordable housing to the environment to responsible development and planning, Social Security, artificial intelligence. And tonight, we take a little bit of a different twist, because in each one of those topics, we intentionally assembled a panel of people, of experts in the field, and we intentionally assembled a panel of people that might disagree with each other, that had differing viewpoints. And we asked our spotlight audiences to listen with empathy, to listen closely, to not discount somebody who had an opinion different than theirs. And tonight's going to be a little bit different of a spotlight series, because tonight we're going to talk about how we can take this message of empathy and spread it far and wide. You know, one of the rules I like to joke about for spotlight is that we have the anti-Vegas rule, right? What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in spotlight events like this, you need to spread far and wide. We're asking you to share this message, what you learn tonight. Don't keep it to yourselves. Please share it. The events like this don't happen without a great group of people. And let me first start with the folks that greeted you at the door, that checked you in. If you feel welcomed and engaged tonight, that's because of the wonderful colleagues that I get to work with each and every day at the Tampa Bay Times. Please help me give them a round of applause. And of course, events like this don't happen without the great generosity of our sponsor, the Foundation for a Healthy St. Petersburg. The foundation has sponsored many of our spotlight discussions, and we're so grateful for their generosity and for opening their doors to have us in this wonderful facility to have this great conversation and to learn from each other. The Foundation for a Healthy St. Petersburg shares with the Tampa Bay Times the belief that we as a community will only get better if we learn from each other, if we learn to listen and we learn to share with honesty and clarity. And so to tell us more about the foundation, let's watch a short video, and then we're going to hear from the president and CEO, Dr. Kanika Tomlin, about the foundation's great work and how you can help support it. Thank you.
At the foundation, we know that optimal health outcomes and well-being should be an attainable reality for all of us, regardless of our race, regardless of our ethnicity, our gender, geography, or income. We also know that all too often, this just is not the case. So we are working to advance racially equitable health outcomes in our community by improving the systems and conditions that shape them. We do this work through four primary pathways. We lead, fund, partner, and advocate. We are working to create equitable opportunities for all of us. This is the data. This is the truth. This is our work. No one can do this work alone. It takes a full ecosystem of support, and we are all a part of that ecosystem. Now that we know better, it's time for us to do better. So let's do so together. Good evening. Again, welcome to the Foundation for a Healthy St. Petersburg's Center for Health Equity. We are so glad that you are here. Thank you for joining us for this important conversation about building connections in what can too often feel like divisive times. I am Dr. Kanika Tomlin, and I have the privilege of serving as the president and CEO of the Foundation for a Healthy St. Petersburg. As you heard in our video, every day we lead, partner, advocate, and fund to create a community in which good health helps all people thrive. To do that with excellence, we must engage people from every corner of our community. not only those who champion our work, the takers, if you will, but those who would just as soon leave it as well. To truly create conditions where our destinies are determined by equitable access, exposure, and our own agency-fueled decisions, we need a fully engaged community, a community where each one of us can live in the fullness of our potential and everyone has a role to play in shaping our respectful coexistence. But to get to that point of finding our shared interests, the common ground and reason to move beyond indifference toward engagement, we must first connect. We must talk with each other. We must see each other, and we must challenge our assumptions about all that divides us. And that challenge, ideally, will be fueled by an understanding of all that unites us. But how do we do that? How do we get to that place? How do we transform such high-minded rhetoric into reality? We all know it's easier said than done, especially when the differences feel so real and so defining. I'm the fifth generation of my family to call St. Pete home. It's awesome. And in my hometown, I've had the privilege of holding a variety of roles in our community, from journalist to healthcare executive, deputy mayor and city administrator to leader of this wonderful philanthropy. I've attended summer camp at Campbell Park and as a kid, and then decades later cut ribbons on a skate park I helped to build there. I played at the pier as a child and then as deputy mayor led its redevelopment. I share that to share that I've been the beneficiary of our city's resources and its opportunities and a principal arbiter in how they will be allocated. And in that position, from those experiences, I can tell you that there are dozens of different versions of life in our city. Countless different ways of growing up, of supporting our families, of navigating our city's landscape. A myriad of realities so complex it's hard to fathom that they all come from and together in this one place. And every one of them is real. Every one of them is relevant and right to the person, to the families, to the people who are experiencing them. And across that diverse landscape into which people are born and live under these vastly different conditions, raised in households that hold wildly different viewpoints, while navigating the same world down notably different paths, is it possible to converge at a point of shared understanding? Without judgment, absent sanctimony, without feeling a need for divergent views and ways to align with our own in order to be considered valid. We are all here together tonight because we believe that it is possible. In fact, we know that civil coexistence and the holding of responsible perspectives that do no harm, respect difference, and honor our shared humanity must be a reality in our community. It must be if we are to access the promise of an inclusive culture where our individual and collective brightest futures wait to rise. However, nothing about that work is easy or automatic. It only happens with effort and intention. So welcome to the effort and congratulations on the intention. We are so pleased to partner with the Tampa Bay Times to create this space, this safe space for people from different cross-sections of our community to come together and learn from a panel of experts who are skilled in building connections and identifying common ground. They'll share their depth of knowledge on the role empathy plays in all of this and how, most importantly, we can translate that empathy into action. So maybe it's your plan to use what you learned tonight in your personal lives. It will make for great skill at the Thanksgiving table. Or maybe you'll apply it in your jobs or in conversations with well-meaning but differently persuaded friends. Wherever you use it, if you come away from tonight with tools to connect in a way that is genuine, heartfelt, respectful, and civil, our community will be stronger and healthier for it. Because connecting with other people is not just good for our health, it's necessary.
It's as necessary as doctor's visits and healthy food. It enriches our lives, eases our stress, reduces isolation, and boosts our sense of connection and understanding of our purpose in this world. Being socially connected helps all of us live longer and happier and healthier lives. So we all have something to learn from one another. We all have a role to play. We all have a perspective to share. Everyone in this room, everyone in our community has much to contribute and much to receive. And that best happens when we move beyond our differences to find the common ground that defines quality of life in this place that we are so fortunate to call home. That takes tools, it takes practice, it takes commitment, and we are offering all of the above tonight. So thank you for being here. Thank you for taking the time to build bridges and connect with those around you, those you love, and those who are very hard to love. Together we are stronger, and together we will create a community where good health really does help all people thrive. And now it's my pleasure to turn the microphone over to columnist Stephanie Hayes, a bright light who illuminates every room she enters. Stephanie?
Thank you. So nice. Thank you all for being here. I'm seeing some familiar faces out there from the community. It's nice to see you all. Thank you, Dr. Tomlin and Conan and this everyone involved in getting us here together in the room tonight. This is an incredible gathering, and I think we're going to have a good conversation. In my job, I often have the floor, for better or worse. I'm sure you'll tell me. But that's fine. You can tell me. We can talk. But the reason we're here tonight is to communicate and to hear both sides. And so in that spirit, I wanted to read a reader email that I got. Is Tom Lamont here? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. He didn't know. Tom, I wrote a column promoting this event saying what we were going to do. And I said, you know, it's not going to be all softball. It's going to be a good talk. And Tom wrote me and he said, okay, you convinced me to sign up and drive from Clearwater in rush hour traffic with sun in my face, so this better be good. No self-righteousness and self-affirming crosstalk permitted. I'm bringing Ziploc bags, and don't think I won't use them to take home food if the panel gets all huggy bear kissy face. How was your drive? Bad. Okay. We're going to dive in by getting to know our panel. They're incredible, so I want to give a few minutes for their bios. So to my left here, Michael Tennant is an entrepreneur, author, and creator of Curiosity Lab, and he was hosting the game in the front here. That's a purpose-driven creative studio. He's created a line of products to teach empathy skills, including Actually Curious, a conversation game featured by the New York Times, Beyonce, and Oprah. Never heard of them. The Power of Empathy, a best-selling book that shares insights and stories on how empathy can transform lives and businesses, and his Five Phases of Empathy workshop, which helps people and organizations develop and apply empathy skills. He has taught at NASA, Johns Hopkins, casual. Michael, everybody. Okay. Next, we have Kelly McBride, one of the country's leading voices on media ethics and democracy. She is Senior Vice President and Chair of the Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership at the Poynter Institute, which does own the Tampa Bay Times, a great friend to us, where she guides professional news organizations in best practices. She also serves as NPR's public editor, listening to audience feedback to uphold NPR accountable to their mission to serve the public. She's worked at public editor at ESPN and co-edited the book, The New Ethics of Journalism, Guiding Principles for the 21st Century. Kelly McBride. Next up, we have Jeffrey Collins, a professor of humanities and interim associate director of the Hamilton School for Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida. He is a historian of ideas with a focus on early modern political thought. He is the author of two books, as well as many articles and book chapters on subjects such as religious war, toleration, atheism, church, and state. He is a regular contributor to the Times Literary Supplement and the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Jeffrey, who drove here from Gainesville to be with us tonight. Tammy Bryant Spratling is a lawyer, visiting assistant professor in the University of South Florida's College of Education, and vice chair of Community Tampa Bay, which promotes dialogue and cross-cultural interaction. She previously served as assistant dean for student affairs at Stetson Law and assistant state attorney in the Child Welfare Division of the Sixth Circuit. Tammy speaks on transformative learning theory, law, the modern civil rights movement, diversity and inclusion, with a focus on implicit bias. Welcome, Tammy. And what did you say, if you're not first, you're last, something?
The first shall be last, the last shall be first.
Is the Reverend, Dr. Reverend Russell Meyer, Executive Director of the Florida Council of Churches, where his work operates across faith to accent the values of our shared humanity. His doctoral work focused on designing community conversations that lead to collective action using social field theory, which is a fascinating conversation we had on the phone. He engages in statewide interfaith efforts on climate, healthcare, justice reform, refugees, and civic engagement. And he has helped create several programs to foster more conversational leadership in Tampa Bay. Thank you so much. So that is our panel. They're incredible. I write little columns. That's my bio. We're going to get right into the questions. And we're going to kick it off with Jeff. So here's a big one for you. People casually say that we've never been more divided, that things have never been worse. And I always find it helpful to go, is that true? So you're a professor of history. Have things ever been this bad?
I don't know if it will comfort people or cause discomfort to say, yes, they've been this bad before, many, many times. I'm a student of the early modern European scene, which was racked by religious wars. Millions died in the most brutal ways, Protestants fighting Catholics, Catholics fighting Protestants fighting each other, Christians fighting Muslims. But if we just look to American history, of course, there are terrible periods of division in our own history. I mean, the Civil War is the obvious case. 750,000 Americans died, some defending, you know, a brutal system of slavery. But there are other periods one could point to. The 1920s is a period of enormous economic division and truly terrible racial violence, the high point of the KKK and lynching. But I think for someone like me on a university campus, I think it's fair to say that the 60s kind of emerge as a closer parallel, less violent than those earlier periods, but somewhat similar in patterns to our own moment, in that some of the same features are present today that we saw in the 60s. Protest culture on divisive protest culture on college campuses and anger about that in the public. During COVID, a certain amount of urban unrest. I think, though, many people in this room will remember the 60s. My students don't remember the 60s at all. I'm 55. I was born in 1970, so I don't actually remember the 60s. But the 60s are to them as the 20s were to me, so it's a little sobering to think about. But, of course, the campus protests in the 60s were much more violent. I mean, students lost their lives, of course. And even the student protests were quite violent. At Cornell University, the buildings were taken over at gunpoint, and the president of the university was held at gunpoint. And the urban rioting in the 60s was much more violent as well. I mean, the Detroit riots, something on the order of 50 people died. In the Watts riots, 35 people died. There were thousands and thousands of arrests. And, of course, the assassination culture of the 60s was much worse. Though we're veering back towards that in alarming ways. So I think in some ways the 60s on those measures was worse, but I will say that I think some things about our present moment are maybe worse than they were in the 60s. Some of the softer things, the quieter things that may not be as obvious. And I'm talking about things like social isolation, polarized and divided media environments. I think a lot of this is demographic and technological. So a certain series of demographic trends are meeting a kind of technology that is dividing and isolating us. And this is probably an obvious point to many of you. And it's not just the kids who are addicted to their phones. I was reading a study about how older Americans are using their phones all the time now and speaking and conversing less and less. But what this means is we have a completely collapsed, really, associational culture. I feel funny saying this in a room full of this many people attending a public lecture or a public panel. This almost never happens. I'm amazed. So this is a bit of counter evidence, and congratulations to you. But this is pretty rare these days. The sociologist Thaddeus Skocpol wrote a book a few years ago demonstrating that the kinds of civic associational activities, Elks clubs, Rotary clubs, and so forth, where people would mingle with people from different classes and different religions and different races, they've basically disappeared. We don't even go to movies anymore. We watch movies at home. We shop at home. We eat out at home, if you will. So, I mean, and we live alone, increasingly. In 1940, only 7% of Americans lived in a single-person household. That number is up to 28%. And there are demographic reasons for that, but my own feeling about our problems today is that it's a combination of those technological distractions, which keep us from being bored, and boredom is what forces us out into society and to meet new people, right? But it also is combined with a kind of loneliness epidemic that creates certain paranoid reaction to the news, a certain obsessive attention to kind of curated news sources, a kind of phony community online, and so forth. And all these things are making us more and more distant from each other.
That's really grounding as we have this conversation, both to know this isn't fake, it's bad out there, but we've also gotten through things before. So it's both, to answer your initial premise. Michael, Roxane Gay wrote recently in a guest essay for the New York Times that she believes civility is a fantasy, that this idea that we can have these civil conversations is just not realistic anymore. I'm wondering, what's your take on that, the fact that a lot of people just seem to be sort of done with this type of work?
Yeah, I think it's a real perspective, and I'm blessed to see this room of people who saw in the newspaper, "Can we still talk?" And some maybe two to 300 people decided to come. So it's amazing evidence that we're not all done. There is a large amount of us who still have hope. But when I read that article, one thing that I was really impressed by, that really resonated with me, was her Roxane's ability to just articulate how civility can be hypocritical at times. It can be performance. It can be, at times, weaponized. And I think that very much is part of my entry into even working in empathy. I can remember before, some of you have gotten the opportunity to play my conversation game, Actually Curious. We made it in 2018 when we thought the country was the most divided that it had ever been or would ever be. And at the time, I was actually a very, very different person. The moment that comes to mind, I went away to boarding school. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I went to a boarding school in Pottstown, PA. And it was a very, very new environment. One of my very best friends that I met on my hall, we were just 14-year-olds playing video games. We came from very different backgrounds. He came from rural Virginia. You know, I knew of his background. He actually came from a slaveholding family. And it was a topic that we were able to discuss as 14-year-olds and still just, go on and play sports and hang out, like cheat on study hall hours sometimes. But, years later, about 2017, we were living on the same block just randomly in New York City. And we were hanging out, and I noticed, having some beers, as guys do in their 20s, and I noticed that our conversations, particularly when they got onto important topics, just started to get a lot more tense. And soon, the frequency of us hanging out reduced, and we text each other every once in a while and do this sort of civil overture that we're still friends, but we never actually make much effort. And so that was back then. And back then, I would hear a topic, or I would hear, some of my peers would be really well-versed, not as good as Dr. Collins over here, but just at stating the facts, and I would shut down. I would just, I didn't feel equipped. I didn't feel confident engaging in those topics. So we created a game that would gamify helping people like me, or helping kind of bridge the gap between someone who's confident engaging in topics and someone who is maybe knowledgeable, well-meaning, has something to contribute, but doesn't have the ability to jump all the way into the deep end. And I think that's important, because as I started to play that game, I realized that there are things, like I even experience a little bit of this now, where I have an opportunity to have my voice be heard, and I start to shake, or my mind gets a little more less clear than it was. And I actually know that of myself, so I can resource myself. But it's because I learned that I needed to practice, and that I could strengthen my ability as showing up in those conversations authentically. I could say, hey, I have something to say, but I need us to go a little bit slower because the speed that we're going at, I can't engage. Would you like to hear me? But I have that confidence now. So I think there's a lot of hope, but I think we have to rebuild the skill set necessary to go from light to deep, or to even conceive that that is something that's necessary in order to engage in these conversations.
I love the honesty. As a journalist, early in my career, I realized there was great power in just telling somebody, I'm actually really nervous to be interviewing you right now, or this is a really hard question that I don't want to ask. And it sort of takes the tension out of the interaction. And I feel that it's something we can do in our day-to-day lives as well, is say like, hey, I know this is bad, but we need to talk about it anyway. So that's a wonderful topic or point you made. Russell, Conan mentioned this a little bit, but there's a chasm in perception of society versus how we feel about ourselves. And there is a study done recently that shows Americans perceive themselves as civil on an individual level, but they don't perceive society as being civil. And I'm wondering, you've done a lot of work in the area of the collective. What does it take to change a collective consciousness to where we can go, actually, society is civil?
Well, this, I think, is important for us to understand the large moment we're in. So many voices want us to focus on the headline, and I know you, that's how you sell newspapers. But the large moment of just what is happening to us as a species, and what the human footprint looks like on Earth right now. Humanity has never gotten to this stage that it's at right now. So before COVID, one of the things that I was fond of saying, you know, the sense of individual sovereignty is now universal. Even people who grow up in the burials of Rio de Janeiro believe they have independent agency, sovereign personality. And Dr. Collins' European history could probably take us down the road of how, for most of human history, there were just two classes, the aristocracy and the serfs. There wasn't the sense of I am my own person, I am my own agent, is universalized across the world today in a way that has never existed in human history. This is a fundamental shift in our collective consciousness that we are just now beginning to engage in and to become part of what does this mean, not just for me, but for all of us, for being human. What is the human project? Where is it going? Is it based, are you based in hope or are you based in fear? Now, we know, we've all experienced it, that billionaires are making money off of our fears. And all you have to do is turn on your social media. And so there is a terrible feedback loop there. And we have a kind of economic system globally that says, you know, if somebody wants to taunt you, they can get away with it, right? I remember my grandmother growing up, when I would get mad at my brother, she'd stop me and she said, count to 10. Imagine if we had a council of grandmothers who turned to the tech bros and said, hey, count to 10 before you launch that algorithm. right? So first, let's just understand the moment that we're all standing in. We have reached a place in the human race where everybody feels like they deserve the right to participate. No question about it, right? So that sense of being, I can be myself. Not just I can be somebody, but I can be myself. And the world accepts me being me. That's in tension with another concern, and that is my deepest self. I dare say your deepest self, more than anything else in the world, wants to be loved. And you would give your wealth to be deeply and unconditionally loved. I know I'm giving mine away to my grandchildren right now, right? And so we live in this tension about belonging and being. And we have these technological wonders out there that are restricting what we're doing with that. And so we're doing this delicate balance. It's really helpful in this moment if we reflect on common images that are just out there that we see in the world every day in Mother Nature. One of my favorite ones is the story of the butterfly. And the story of the butterfly is this. It begins as a caterpillar. And you know what a caterpillar does? It consumes everything in its path 24/7 until it creates so much outcome, it encases itself in its old leftovers. I'm trying to be civil here, right? Are you following me?
Oh, yeah.
All right. And then once it's encased in all of that stuff, dries hard, every cell in it breaks down and becomes something else. And what emerges is a butterfly. And then the journey of the butterfly, I love this part, get this part. The journey of the butterfly is to pollinate everything it can so the rest of the world can be fed. I think we're kind of at the cocoon moment right now, right? And all you got to do is turn on your social media and you can see us being buried in it. But if we step back and we look at, you know, what makes the story of me powerful for me, if we ask that each about ourselves, the next thing we want to do is share our story with somebody else who will receive it the way a newborn child receives its mother's smile. And when we are heard that way, I mean, our whole humanity comes into play. So I know that the only way I can truly be is if somebody hears my story, which then means the only way I can truly be is to hear somebody else's story because they have the same need that I have. So this is the secret of empathy. And when you look at empathy anthropologically, evolutionary biology, we would have never got to this moment today without it. And so we now have the capacity collectively across the globe to understand that the next stage of our human being is our shared empathy and understanding how we all become butterflies.
Lovely. Okay, Tammy, we are all encased in our own detritus.
Tough to follow.
We would like to get out of it.
Straight to the lawyer on that one.
Straight to the lawyer. We need some tools. How? Okay, seriously, one of the hardest things about this conversation is that it's all well and good in concept to say, like, let's listen to each other, let's make room for another point of view. What if the other person's point of view is that they hate you, or that they, you know, how, you know, the old joke goes, we can disagree about pizza toppings, but not human rights. How do we begin to have that kind of conversation with somebody when it's at that deep of a difficult level?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me and asking me such an incredible question that I'm super passionate about. I love pepperoni pizza, and it's my absolute favorite. I'm a purist. If we were to tool this entire room with an opportunity to be surveyed, and you, in fact, actually, if I were to do that right now, I'd ask you all to close your eyes, because if I said, do you like pineapple on pizza? You would feel pretty passionate about that, and you might not even feel safe enough to respond, right? Because let me tell you, this is a very intense topic of which many people have had very rousing debates about whether there should be pineapple on pizza. So let's not forget that that's an important debate. But in all seriousness, when we're talking about human rights, we are in a different level of dialogue and debate. It's another intensity. It's an intensity of emotion. I think about our youth, and our Community Tampa Bay Anytown program graduates a class of Anytowners every summer, and they come from across the Tampa Bay area to participate in cross-cultural interaction and dialogue. And by the end of the week, they have a toolkit of discussion that they can have with other young people or with adults, frankly. I've been told that lots of conversations at the parent table are different after they've gone to Anytown. So there's something that happens with them. And I'm thinking about one of our youth who I will not name, but I'm remembering that we actually sent her to a conference, a leadership conference in Washington, D.C. And she met other youth, incredible leaders from across our country. And in their social time, in their evening dormitory, they were all walking around, running around, talking with each other. And one of the other youth asked her where she came from. And she explained that she was Venezuelan. And he asked if she got into our country legally. And she said, yes, I did come into this country legally. And he said, well, if you make me angry, can I call ICE on you and have you deported? And she said, no. And she disengaged. And so I want you to hear that, because she comes back and she talks to us about it. And she says, every single youth needs to go to Anytown. Because every single youth is then going to learn how to have dialogue. And to be able to have useful dialogue that's respectful and builds connection and builds respectability and compassion and kindness, as opposed to division. And so I think about her when I think about this question, because the comments are out there, and they're abhorrent, and they are impactful, and they create fear. We have communities of people that are staying in their homes, not just out of isolation, but because they're fearful, because they are afraid that their entire life will be upended in a moment. And so it's a really tough time to have dialogue. And I use the word dialogue because oftentimes we find ourselves in conversation with each other. But conversation and dialogue are two different things. And I want to talk about the foundations of dialogue, because the foundations of dialogue are important things that we can walk out of this room with, particularly when we are thinking about those conversations in the buffet line at the Thanksgiving dinner over the mashed potatoes, right? Not exactly the time, perhaps, for us to ask the dear old uncle his perspectives on immigration, right? Because that is a time for a conversation and not a time for dialogue. So what does dialogue look like? Well, the first thing is that it has a purpose. Dialogue is not talking about the weather. Dialogue is not like when I talked to my mom today, where she told me about the neighbor next door's cousin's brother who just was laid off. I don't know who they are. I have to ask for names every single time I talk to her. Those are conversations. A dialogue has a purpose. We're entering into a discussion with a purpose, right? So that's the first thing that we need. We also need to have mutual respect, right? We have to be able to go into a dialogue recognizing that my perspectives are valid and your perspectives are valid. Now, dialogue can also happen between more than two people. So I just want to make sure that you know that. It could be one, three, five, 10, right? But a good dialogue is going to be 8 to 10, just so you know. That's a true strategy. So it's going to have a level of respect. It's also going to be consensual. During the buffet, you know, conversation, if you begin to talk about perspectives of immigration, that other person may be here saying, hey, I'm just here for the mashed potatoes, right? They're not a part of that dialogue yet. So I invite you to think about how you are going to ensure that the person that you are dialoguing with is dialoguing with you as well, right? Dialogue also recognizes that we come into spaces with assumptions and oftentimes binary assumptions, either good or bad or right or wrong. And so dialogue tells us that we need to eradicate those assumptions and be open to the non-binary spaces and to understand that there are all sorts of perspectives and assumptions that we're walking into the conversation with, and we want to make sure that those aren't impacting the dialogue. And then the final piece is dialogue encourages and embraces diverse perspectives. So it seems obvious, I think, at this point, that we're not having dialogue to prove our point. We're having a dialogue to move forward a purpose. And it's really important for us to recognize that there are different people that have different perspectives, and we can have a dialogue around those things rather than automatically jumping to those assumptions. When I think about my generation, I think our contribution to this conversation is that we have trained ourselves a lot of times to be Red Rover, Red Rover, let someone come over, which is the recognition that we are getting into conversations to persuade people to our side as opposed to being curious about other people's side. And so I offer those five foundations of dialogue as those opportunities for us to stop and pause, slow down, like grandmothers say, count to 10, think about, do you have a purpose in this engagement? What is that purpose? Is the person that you're talking to signed on to this conversation or to this dialogue? Is there mutual respect? Are you not making assumptions? And if you are doing those things, I trust that you will have more productive dialogue that will be respectful and hopefully forward moving for your connections with the people that you're talking with, particularly the ones that you love. Because I know it's tough right now. I've personally had some situations where family or friends are not as quite as close as they used to be.
I'm going out to dinner on Thanksgiving with my husband. It's going to be great. Kelly, this is perfect segue into what I want to talk to you about. One of the many things you do in the media space is NPR public editor. And many people might not know what that is, but one of your functions there is to wade through the listener responses and see what point people are trying to make, if they're in good faith, if they're just trying to provoke. I wonder if you could tell us how you identify a good faith consumer versus a bad faith consumer. And I think you have some materials to support this.
I brought slides. So I get in my job as NPR public editor about 750 emails a week. And they all have to be read, and I have to sort through them all, and I have help doing that. I have a very, very good staff. But we have to find letters that we can engage with. And it took me a long time to figure out that a lot of times when people enter into a public conversation, they actually don't want to engage, right? They want to fight. And so my first piece of advice is you really have to discern whether the person that you want to display empathy with and have a conversation with, do they want to be in that conversation? And so I look at a couple of, I look for a couple of things. And the first thing is do they actually ask a genuine question? Or are they asking a hypothetical question or a rhetorical question or an argumentative question, right? A genuine question is a skill. And many, many people have to practice it before they get very good at it. Do they reveal something about who they are or why they care about this issue? I think that that's really important, and it goes very much to what my fellow panelists have said here. Do they leave room for doubt? Because that's really important. And do we leave room for doubt, right? Because if we can't say what we aren't certain about, if all we can talk about is what we're really certain about, then we're probably not engaging in a dialogue. And then the last thing is are they able to, and you might describe this as being respectful, but just can they confer humanity, or with their language, are they denying humanity? And so I brought two letters as an example because I wanted to get really specific. So this first one, these first couple slides are a letter that I did answer. About 50% of the letters that come into my inbox have to do with Israel and Gaza. So Andrew Ziffer, so I answered this. And if you guys, all my stuff is online. You can subscribe to an email that comes every Thursday, npr.org/publiceditor. You can get there. So this gentleman, Andrew Ziffer, wrote, "I've been a proud NPR contributor for over a decade. When federal funding for NPR came under threat, I actually increased my monthly donation because I believe in the mission of public media and the importance of independent journalism. But this morning's coverage left me deeply disappointed. On the anniversary of the October 7th massacre, your programming chose to focus on the story of a Palestinian family in Gaza. That story, while human and important, could have been aired on any other day. To run it on October 7th felt profoundly inappropriate and insensitive to the memory of more than 1,200 innocent Israeli civilians who were brutally murdered. Equally troubling, I did not hear any coverage representing the Israeli side of the story this morning. No remembrance, no interviews, no acknowledgement of the trauma still felt by Israeli families. This morning was not a matter of perspective. It was a failure of judgment and empathy. The date, the tone, the framing were all wrong for what should have been a solemn day of remembrance and moral clarity." Right? That was a really good letter. Right? And so he doesn't quite ask a genuine question, but he offers a genuine concern. Right? It felt inappropriate and insensitive to the memory of October 7th. He reveals himself, right? He says, "I've been a proud contributor. I believe in the mission of public media." So he offers up a little bit about who he is. And then he really does offer room for doubt. He says that story, while human and important, could have aired any other day. So, and then the other thing that he does is he's very specific in his criticism. And the last thing is that he does confer humanity, right? He recognizes the humanity of the people that he is criticizing. So I'll share another letter that I did not answer, right? And this is, I would say, out of the 750 letters that I get every week, more than half are people who are not interested in actually having a dialogue or an exploration. They're just interested in arguing and fighting. So this, and I didn't include this letter writer's name, another virulently one-sided NPR report. All things considered, I heard it after the 5:30 p.m. headlines. It was an interview with Anshel Pfeffer, the Israeli correspondent for The Economist. I did not catch her interviewer's name, but it was a woman. Pfeffer is also a correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which your interviewer didn't bother to disclose is harshly critical of the Israeli government. Pfeffer wrote the 2018 book, Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu, and here was discussing the 2023-25 Gaza war. The most blatantly biased content in this report was when Pfeffer stated as fact that Netanyahu, quote, prolonged the Gaza war in order to stay in office or in power, depending on which person was speaking. Although widely believed, this is a hypothesis. Based on a certain body of evidence, it has not been established as a fact, but your interviewee stated it as such with its all too usual bias. The NPR interviewer let this pass unquestioned. A news outlet presenting a hypothesis, even a credible hypothesis, as fact, how is that responsible or ethical journalism? Right, that's the question. That's the first question in that whole letter. And it's not a real question, right? It's a rhetorical question. How is this responsible or ethical journalism? Missing from the piece any representation of an imposing viewpoint on this contentious topic. Okay, except for about 10 seconds of this report, which was 5 or 6 minutes long. So are they specific? No, this is an entire litany of complaints. Is there any room for doubt in this letter? There is not. Do they confer humanity or do they dismiss humanity, right? The language itself takes away the humanity of the people that they are talking about. So this is an example of a letter that this person, there's no satisfying this person. There's no answer that I can provide. And because I only have so much time and energy, so many resources in a day. I really think it's my responsibility to choose to engage in productive conversations. And so the skills that my staff and I have learned in all of this, and I feel like I could have read any of your work and it wouldn't have taken me 5 years to get here, but because I think that if we are asking this of our letter writers, we have to do this too. In the work that we do. These are the skills that I think you need to have to enter into a true dialogue, and they're very similar to what you just said. But you have to be able to describe how you arrived at the point that you're at on whatever issue, right? Not just what your argument is, but how did you get here? How did your beliefs evolve over time so that you're here at this point? And that automatically changes the conversation because it's not about whether you're right or wrong, but it anchors you in a point in time and acknowledges that beliefs change over time. Being able to articulate where you have doubts is really important. More important than where you are certain is where you have doubts. Being able to muster up some curiosity about the other person, which is everything that you're working on, right? If you can't muster genuine curiosity, then you're maybe not prepared to be in a dialogue. And that is something for us, like I can't do it all day, every day, right? It takes an emotional toll. And so you really do have to get yourself to a point that you can do it. You can't show up without being ready and being prepared. And then this asking genuine questions, like I'll just give you the trick. A genuine question usually starts with the word how or why, right? It cannot be answered with yes or no. And if you can ask a genuine question, you are 50% of the way there. And many people can't. And I worry because of this whole environment that we're in, the isolation and the technology, that online conversations have trained people to not be to not be able or capable of engaging in these real conversations.
These are great tips. So at Thanksgiving, you're going to turn to Uncle Bob and say, I believe that's a rhetorical question and not a genuine question. Would you like to rephrase that? And Uncle Bob's going to go, and then walk away.
Another trick is, a genuine question is one that you actually don't know the answer to. Right? You're asking it because you want to find out the answer.
Yeah. But in all honesty, I do think these are, the things that you do on a daily basis are applicable in our daily lives. Maybe, you know, if we have the framework in which to start to build these questions in our daily lives, we can do it. We are rapidly running out of time, and I want to get to audience questions. So I did have another round for you all, but I'm going to try to combine them with the audience questions so we make sure to hear from you all. But before I ask these, fun surprise, funtivity, reach under your seats, and one lucky person is going to get a copy of my book and a copy of Michael's cards. So go ahead and reach under and then wave wildly like you're on The Price is Right if you are the lucky winner. Anybody? Looking, looking. Nope. It was all a dramatic ruse. Yay! We have a winner. Okay. We will get you those items after the event. Oh, Annika has it right now. She's on the stick. It's a collection of my columns and one of Michael's card games. So thank you for coming tonight, and we hope you enjoy those. I'm going to read some of these out, and we'll hear from our panel a little bit more. Okay, thank you for writing these. Okay, this is a comment. Maybe we can weave it into a question. It says, not feeling welcome in unfamiliar social situations these days. Feeling too much hate in America. Okay, so basically this is the idea of this takes work. I'm not feeling welcome. I'm not comfortable. Jeffrey, I would like to throw this one at you because you part of your job at UF is teaching young people who maybe are uncomfortable to be having these conversations for the first time with people from wildly different experiences. How do you kind of broach this awkwardness that can be going on in the room?
Yeah. So we have a class at UF that's required of all the students on civil discourse. And so this is kind of a subject of discussion and instruction. And the students want this. They really do want this. I mean, a lot of the headlines about universities are kind of the fighting and the protest and the disruptions and so forth, but students really are craving kind of intellectual engagement and community. And one of the reasons they don't do it very often, and it's not just the civility part, it's the conversation part, is because in class, they're worried about being judged. They're worried about being criticized. And students of that age are, they crave appreciation and approval. And so you have to establish the terms of civility to get the conversation going. Rather than incivility, the more common problem in a university classroom is apathy or silence because they're afraid to speak. So civility has to be established with a set of rules, really. And I don't think they're particularly complicated rules. They map onto some of the things that have already been said here. But one of the rules I try to establish in my classes is that what goes on in the classroom, and you can only encourage this, you can't enforce it necessarily, but the students are really receptive, doesn't get made into a subject of gossip outside the classroom, and certainly doesn't get posted on social media, which happens. You have to establish habits. They can't talk over each other. They have to listen. They have to try to respond to the question rather than change the topic so they can speechify. One of the things I do in my classes is get them all to write one question about the subject of the day or the reading. This is sort of like this exercise and this exercise. It forces them to think about how everybody else in the class might answer the question or how a conversation might get started. It takes them about half the term to sort of figure this out. The first couple of weeks of questions are terrible. They're usually like, well, what does John Stuart Mill say on page 6 or something? But by the time you get halfway through the term, they're figuring out how to write a discussion question, which is a way of engaging other people and thinking about how other people might answer it from a perspective that they're learning because they're learning about each other. There's a lot of other things, kind of rules of the road that I try to establish. One is interpretive sympathy, which is related to empathy in a way. but you have to sort of put the best charitable interpretation on any remark. Avoid. You have to teach them about things like ad hominem attacks or confirmation bias and so forth that they recognize, begin to recognize in themselves. In the media, you'll often hear that the problems are the professors. The professors are indoctrinating people and so forth, and occasionally that does happen. But I think the real challenge of teaching university students these days is that dynamic among the students and how to encourage a healthy dynamic of conversation among the students, because they're afraid of being judged or mocked or pigeonholed.
Well, kind of along the same line, Michael, I have a question here for you. You mentioned your friend and how things, your perspectives change as you grow older and things. This person says, am I compromising my own values if I stay friends or hang out with people who support cruelty, injustice, and hypocrisy? That's a tough one.
I think it's the right question to ask. And it's something that I contemplate. In the model that I use to teach empathy, it's called the five phases of empathy. And it starts with phase one, the language of feelings, which is actually getting a better understanding of your nervous system. How do you show up in conflict? How do other people show up in conflict? How do you show up in joy? The whole spectrum. You start to build a better map. Phase two, the importance of intention, brings in your values. And something really wonderful that I discovered is when I'm feeling a strong, complicated feeling, if I have a clear articulation of my values, it's a really, really helpful tool for me to claim choice, which is phase three. And I'm only going to give you the first three. You have to check out The Power of Empathy to read all five. But the power of choice, when you have better control over your nervous system. I grew up in a different home. I didn't have a grandmom. And my mom was at work. I was with my brothers. They beat me up. And then I would learn to try to fight back. Had a completely different effect on my programming as far as how I show up in conflict. But after doing this work over the last 5 years, facilitating rooms, being in situations where I'm in over my expertise and needing to regulate, I realized that just by noticing my emotions, processing it through my values, I could really have much more control over the words that came out of my mouth, the actions that happened, and ultimately, you get really good at this, how your thoughts run on and on about that topic. And so I guess my answer to you would be, if you can really articulate your values, you may be able to show up in that conversation and move something forward that's not outside of your integrity. Is it about rebuilding the trust? Is it about getting your voice heard a little bit more so that the conditions are better for you to play out your values, which may be to try to shift their opinions a little bit?
Yes. And not everything has to be a fight. You know, with people, I like to diffuse with humor as much as possible and just say something off the wall, and that really disarms people. And then you can kind of get into these prickly topics too. Russell, you have a really interesting academic background in the study of empathy, and this person asked one of the questions I have for you, which is empathy learned or is it natural?
Yes. The number, from what I've read in psychosociology, the number of people who are incapable of empathy is a very small number. That's a organic brain kind of thing that happens there. And one can increase one's empathy. One can practice and do things with it. About 10% of the population are sort of what you might call natural empaths, and they're right there. And that seems historically to be kind of what humanity has needed, because as Professor Collins was saying, you know, at any historical period, you know, society was losing it. And if you go back and you study those periods, at least my findings, what I've read is that the people who rise up in leadership are people who have a strong sense of empathy. Just think of Abraham Lincoln, for instance, during the Civil War. And so we seem to be in a moment right now in our history where empathy is being devalued in leadership. But if you actually look around at who's really performing as leaders in the community, not who has a title of leadership, but who's actually performing as a leader, whether it's in your neighborhood or in the city or in the community, you find those people are highly empathetic. Whatever you think of the mayor-elect of New York City, you should read his speech. Just read his speech. And he is practicing in every sentence one of the highest levels of empathy across all the demographics in the city. You might not agree with his political theories and his economic theories and all that, but he connected empathetically across the board in a very powerful way. So you can learn how to do that. You can become more empathetic. But I'll tell you that, how many have had a profoundly painful experience in the past year? Who have you told about it? Right? And so what we know, deep human history, anthropology, the anthropologists really understand how civilization began by studying funeral practices. And when you find a grave of, say, a child that was born in spina bifida or somebody who had a broken femur and they've been cared for and they lived through adulthood. That's how deeply empathy has been about creating us as a society. And so we can learn, we can focus on that. What are our core values? Doing values work is really important. Coming to understand what your core values are. And then the empathetic question. Would you tell me about what's really valuable to you, right? And so I had a really painful experience. I'll finish with this. My father called me up late in his life. He had finally gone to counseling after the end of his third marriage. And his counselor told him he needed to express his feelings better. Men, we need to work on this. And then he started to read out the list of everything I had done wrong in my life from his perspective. And I said, Dad, what are you doing? I said, well, my counselor told me to share my feelings. I said, not one of those are feelings. Those are all of opinions. You know what? I got 10,000 more, right? Are you happy or are you sad? Are you mad or are you glad, right? Tell me about your feelings. Tell me, and those feelings then connect to what our values are, our hopes and our disappointments in life. Tell me your life story. That's what you haven't been doing, Dad. That's what you need to do. That's what we all need to do.
Thank you. that was funny. I remember reading once that everybody, a really good way to engage people is to ask or to say when they tell you what they do, to say, that sounds really challenging. And whether that's President of the United States or fast food worker, people are desperate to be recognized that their lives are full of challenge that you just don't understand. And it can really take that moment of slowing down and asking that question to get a little deeper with somebody. We're gonna do two more questions before we wrap up here. This is great, you guys are right on time. The questions are awesome. Kelly, combine a few here. Can you give us some tips for the holidays when somebody at the dinner table or so forth might come and say, hey, I read this thing or I saw this thing and we know that it's either false or an AI video or coming from a news source that may be heavily biased in one way or another. How can we, should we A, edge the people that we love toward more reputable sources? B, how do we do that?
How many drinks in are we?
I think we're two and a half.
Okay.
Two and a half after that, it's no man's land.
I mean, so questions are really, really important. Do you remember where you saw that? What are your favorite sources of information? If you don't like those sources, you still have to respect that that is their source of information. I will tell you, my youngest kid, until recently, was a big fan of our Secretary of Health and Human Services, and has been following him for years and has shared some of his opinions about vaccines, about raw milk. I think it took me a long time to stop judging her for that and to recognize that me telling her that his information is bad was not actually going to change her. And that was really hard for me, right? Like, it's really hard when it's your child, right? When it's somebody whose well-being you are responsible for. But what worked with her was to start talking about why she was so interested in these topics. What was her experiences that made her doubtful about modern medicine? She had some really valid experiences. She had some doctors who prescribed medication and didn't follow up, right? She had, and so getting people to discuss their why they're so interested in that topic and why they're really passionate about it, getting them to tell you the journey of how they came to this belief is a much better pathway than, you know, that is fake news, right? Because the fake news is a dehumanizing, dismissive response. Not everybody has the same source of news. Not everybody has the same habits. If you are interested in having a conversation with somebody, then you won't dismiss them because of where they are getting their information.
And there's a way to sort of maybe present a source that is closer to their threshold of belief.
I think that what you really want to get, try not to persuade, try to gain mutual understanding.
Great. Tammy, I'm going to end on this question because I think it sort of sums up everything we're talking about tonight and is the unspoken question of the evening. I'm a high school teacher. God bless you. How can I help students turn empathy into action? What might that look like for young people?
That's such a good question. I love that question. Thank you so much to the audience member that sent that up. And young people, we need to not discount our young people. They know these conversations just as we do as adults, and we need to center their voices 100%. They understand empathy. They live in spaces where they're being judged by their peers. They live in a space where, unlike the majority of this room, when we went to school, if we did something wrong, it wasn't going to end up on social media by the end of that period, right? I mean, it's a very fast space where there can be not only fear of being judged, but real fear that what the consequences of being judged are going to be shared very widely and very broadly. So I think about an activity that we do at Anytown, and I think about this activity because it is an empathy-building activity, but I think about our adults. We had an adult Anytown recently, and the activity goes something like this. If we had the time, I'd love to do something like this. So we have identities across the room, white, black, Hispanic, immigrant, a variety of different identities. And we ask our participants to go around the room and write the most abhorrent things that you know about that community. And they hold no bars, our young people, and neither did our adults, right? Now, our adults were timid. They were like, are you sure? I think I'm gonna run out of this room. This is really awkward, it's really uncomfortable. I'm not really sure what you're doing here. And so we said, just hang with us for a minute. And so they walked around and they wrote all of the slang, all of the abhorrent terms, all of the you know, just the most awful things that you've heard. And we've all heard them because we're all hearing them all the time, right? And so they're on our walls, and then we asked them to take another round, and we asked them to walk around and circle the top three of each of those that we feel like have the most harm associated with them. So they went around and they thought about it and they circled three. Sometimes they had more than three. And we talked about it. We talked about why those were harmful. And then we said, what if you believed those top three things about that group of people? And one of our adults literally said, oh, this is an empathy activity. And it was this recognition that we were flipping the script and recognizing that where this division comes from oftentimes is fear, and that we have to get down to the understanding. I really appreciated your perspective about the place and time. This is, you're angry now, but you've arrived at this moment, right? And we living in this society that has created the historical harms that it has over the history that we've all lived and that we've inherited, we know this. We carry this in us. This is something that exists. And so some of us are carrying those things in a very real way that is very fearful, that is very angering, that is very polarizing and very isolating. And so if we can get people thinking about it at that level, we can begin to be compassionate even when we think that those folks are being angry about someone's humanity or being angry about someone's human rights. And so we start there and we build that space of empathy. And so they listen better and they open up and they're more curious. And so I would say that has to be the foundation, is to do the work to understand that we have to live in a space of curiosity. We have to be humble. We have to have humility. And we have to have courage. Courage to engage. Courage to connect. Courage to break down the things that we've always believed, that now we're being confronted with information that doesn't match that, and be willing to change that. So we start there with them, and then we connect them through resources and community organizations, and we get them out to all sorts of social services organizations and community service organizations to interact with different communities and to begin to have connection with different communities that builds on that empathy that they've begun to explore.
Thank you so much to all our panelists for your time tonight. You were all so insightful and interesting, and we are going to wrap up now, but let's hear it for these guys. Thank you so much. Amazing. And thank you to you all tonight in the audience for your questions and for being so engaged and for filling this room up. This is incredible. Thanks to the Foundation for a Healthy St. Pete. And we do want you to know that the event was recorded. And so if you registered, you will get a link to the event. And you can also read articles and other resources, some of my columns, some of the work from these guys. So look out for that in your email. And before you leave, stop by the Times booth. I believe there's a surprise if you show your app. So that's cool. But you can find out if you want to subscribe, if you want to learn more about the Times, please feel free to do that. But thank you all and have a wonderful night.